pretty good. All right. Quick reminder, as Mark said earlier this morning, lunch will be in the same place as breakfast was in the restaurant. So remember that. Also after lunch, the breakout sessions, there will be signs on the outside the rooms telling you which one is where, and hopefully you kept your yellow sheet so you'll go to the right one or the one that you prefer. Here to talk to us this morning about case law and attorney general opinion updates is Ryan Turner. Of course, Ryan's the general counsel and director of education at the Municipal Courts Education Center. Prior to joining the center, he served as the briefing attorney for Judge Sharon Keller at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. He also currently serves as a deputy city attorney for the city of Dripping Springs, and he previously served as special assistant county attorney in Kendall County. He also helped co-author a book called Lone Star Justice, a comprehensive overview of the criminal justice system. And it's a good book. I recommend that you get it if you can still. Can you still find it?
It's out of print. It's out of print. We're working on another edition.
Second edition. Part two to come. Oh, Transformers 2 starts Friday in my theater.
Good times.
Please welcome Ryan Turner.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How's everyone doing out there? If y'all have let me ask you, were there, how many of y'all stayed in the hotel last night? I'm just curious. Did you have enough pillows? I was just curious. Thought you didn't want to make sure you didn't get shanked on an adequate number of pillows, because guess what? My room was replete with pillows. I had plenty of pillows. All right. Welcome to West Texas. How many of y'all are from West Texas? West Texans? All right. Glad to see we got some West Texans, which means that I'm allowed to logically infer that the rest of you are, dare I say, procrastinators. Welcome to Last Judges School of the Year. Glad you made it. I am here to talk about case law and a couple of attorney general opinions. And so let me go ahead. I see a lot of familiar faces out there, but I'm just curious, if you are new, this is your first judges school, please make your presence known. This is your first rodeo. Got anyone else? Welcome, Judge. Anyone else? All right, well, then let me go ahead and I'll direct my comments just to you for one moment. Like, this is kind of a standard fixture in our regional judges program. I like to sometimes refer to this as just enough information to make you all dangerous. I'm going to be talking to you about a handful of selected opinions from various courts and a couple of AG opinions. And these are all handed down between the dates of August the 31st, 2007, and October the 1st, 2008. So you might be saying, why is this not updated? Well, here's the reason why. Because we're collecting these cases as they're being handed down. And when we start the new academic year, it doesn't matter if you go to school in Odessa or Tyler. You're going to see the same show. So for those of you who are like myself, you tend to be case law enthusiasts. If you really need to get a fix and you want this stuff fresh, hey, come join me out in Tyler, Texas next year. I'll see you in October. Okay. Without further ado, let's go ahead and jump on in. We've got some good stuff to talk about this year. First of all, I want to talk to you about some constitutional issues. The PowerPoint is gratuitous. I don't think you need the PowerPoint. The paper is massive. I would, as judges, ask each of you to read the paper in its entirety if you haven't already. This is the same art. This is the same source material that was featured in the first issue of the Recorder back in, I guess, November or December. Let's start off with talking about a Sixth Amendment case that came out of the United States Supreme Court called Rothgary versus Gillespie County. How many of you are already familiar with this case? At this point in time, the Rothgary effect is beginning to be felt throughout the state of Texas. And if you haven't, that's fine. Let me be the welcome wagon to give you the facts on this. Let's start off with what the question is. The question that's on page one is posed is, what marks the initiation of adversarial judicial proceedings that trigger Sixth Amendment protections? And that's a mouthful. There's no reason why it has to be that complicated. Let's break it down into simpler terms. We all know that the Sixth Amendment guarantees us the individuals who are accused of criminal conduct, you have the right to counsel. And we have had a long-standing kind of tug of war as to, well, how soon does that Sixth Amendment right attach, and what all does that really mean? What does it even mean to attach is another question that kind of comes out of the Rothgary case. If you are a police officer, or I'm just curious, former police officers, got any former police officers in here? Okay, if you are a former police officer, if any of you have ever studied criminal justice. How many of y'all have studied criminal justice, college, junior college? If you've studied any of these things, there is a line of cases that have always suggested that a person's Sixth Amendment right to counsel does not begin until you are in an adversarial stage of litigation, okay? And what that has historically meant to prosecutors and to law enforcement is, you know, when you've got skin in the game, when you've got exposure. So what most people have come to believe, kind of gingerly have come to believe over a period of time, is that your Sixth Amendment rights really don't matter that much until you've been indicted, until there is an information filed against you, or even in a municipal court case, until a formal complaint has been filed against you, okay? That has always been kind of the armchair analysis that Roth-Gary fundamentally challenges. Now, I have to say, this is a classic case where bad facts created case law, okay? And I'm going to say that when I read the question, and let me answer the question. What marks the initiation of adversarial judicial proceedings that trigger Sixth Amendment protections? We used to think it was formal charging by a prosecuting entity. The answer now is magistration. And when I saw that, my ears perked up, because guess what, folks? Most of us are in the magistration business, aren't we? How many of you regularly perform magistrate functions? Okay, that's the reason why this case matters, okay? However, once you start reading the case, it's kind of a wah-wah-wah type moment. It's really somewhat disappointing, because when you read the question and then you hear the answer, you go, oh, this is going to be good. And you get into the analysis to find out this is not exactly Gideon versus Wainwright type stuff. Rather, let me tell you what I think this case is going to be. This case is significant not because of what itself does. It's significant because it sets the stage for an epic battle. It sets the stage for us to have a lot of additional cases to be handed down. It sets the case for trial court judges to start making rulings. And as a result, you'll know how this goes. Once trial court judges make rulings, what comes next? Case law and more case law. So this is kind of the progenitor, I think, of a whole new debate that we're going to have. So let me talk to you about the opinions a little bit, because this is a situation where Mr. Roth-Gary, who's from California, gets arrested in Gillespie County, and the charge that he's arrested on is being a felon in possession of a firearm. And this is based off of data that they're getting, I guess, from NCIC. They see this. They arrest him. He is in jail. He's magistrated by the JP. After a period of time, he actually, you know, I think he bails out or he's released. This is one of those things that we get into one of our Senate Bill 7 type of foils, our Texas Indigent Defense Act. He is subsequently indicted by the district attorney's office, and he is arrested a second time. It's only after he's arrested a second time that under their local indigent defense plan, because remember what I said, formal charging is what most of us thought triggered your Sixth Amendment right to counsel, that's when they get him a lawyer. And you know what that lawyer was able to show without any doubt in a short period of time? Yes, his name is Mr. Roth-Gary, and yes, he did live in California, but guess what? He's never been convicted of anything involving a firearm. Uh-oh. So how many times has this man been arrested now? Twice, okay? When do you think Mr. Roth-Gary thinks he would have liked to have had access to an attorney? Maybe the first time he was in jail and not after the second time he was in jail. Okay, so what you see in Roth-Gary is a lawsuit, and this is a lawsuit against Gillespie County. And what they're saying is you violated our Sixth Amendment rights because you didn't get me a lawyer in a timely manner. Okay, so that's the question. Question goes up to the, this is filed in Judge Yackel's court, in district court in Austin, and Judge Yackel rules against Mr. Roth-Gary. And the case is appealed. Now, I had a chance to talk to Judge Yackel not too long ago, and he said to me, look, I ruled on him based on the law. I wasn't really surprised on the outcome of the case, but based off the law, you know, it was the right decision. So the question goes up to the court, to the United States Supreme Court, and this is where it gets a little interesting, because what the Supreme Court first thing they had to do is they had to make sense of the gibberish, non-official law language that we use here in the great state of Texas. Because folks, there is no such thing as magistration. Okay, it doesn't exist. It's not a word that you can find in the Code of Criminal Procedure. It's a word that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has refused to use in any of its decisions, okay? But how many of y'all have used that word? I know I use it every day. And part of part of the significance of this case in my mind, and I know this shows you I'm a big nerd, is that guess what? We can all use this word now and cite a case because they ended up using the word. This United States Supreme Court ended up using the word. And because it's called different things, and by the way, you need to make sure you understand, this is not an opinion that only affects the state of Texas. This is an opinion that affects every state in the union. So, for the, you know, typically when the U.S. Supreme Court gets involved, they have to be very careful in using technical language. They don't like using technical language because, you know, what you call a municipal court judge in Texas might be a, you know, a court of mastery in some other jurisdiction. You know, and so they're always very careful. But in this specific instance, they went ahead and pulled the pin on this one and said, okay, so the gatekeepers of the criminal justice system, the first judges, the first judicial officers are magistrates. In Texas, this is referred to as magistration. We're going to roll with it. And that's the term they use. I listened to the oral arguments, and I thought that was my favorite part. There's a part of the oral arguments where Judge Scalia is asking them to clarify to make sure that everyone understands what they mean by this magistration stuff. All right. So the state's argument's pretty simple. It can't be critical stage that triggers Sixth Amendment because it's not adversarial, because who is not present when y'all 1517? By the way, I got to stop for a second. I tried to make 1517 an acceptable synonym for magistration. Apparently I have failed, okay? But I did try to use 1517 of the Code of Criminal Procedure as the one that says presentation of the arrested individual before the magistrate. So we get in this thing about, when they're 1517, I'm using my Turnerism for a second, who is present? The defendant, who else? You and who else? Maybe the jailer? Maybe no one? Okay? And so that's the state's argument. State's argument is, how can this be an adversarial judicial proceeding when, one, they haven't been formally charged? And secondly, how can it be an adversarial judicial proceeding when there is no prosecutor present? That's the state's argument. By the way, one member of the court, Justice Thomas, he thought that was pretty persuasive. He dissented. He wouldn't agree with the majority opinion. He was the lone dissenter on this case. He still believes that until you've been formally charged, until a prosecutor is present, Sixth Amendment does not attach because it's not adversarial. And that's his position. That's the summary of his dissent. Okay? However, there is a flaw in this. How many of y'all, anyone out there practice criminal defense law? Got anyone who practices any criminal defense law? I bet you all see the flaw in it, don't you? What's the flaw of that theory? Who does that give all the power in the world to? The prosecution. Because I know some of you might not believe this, but I have heard stories that sometimes prosecutors take a very long time to file formal charges against people, especially in felonies. They draw these things out. And so if you were to believe that all the power belongs to the state and that they get to decide, that's part of the rationale of the decision. The rationale is, no, that's a judge, that municipal judge, that JP, that's a judge. That thing you call magistration, that's a judicial proceeding. And guess what? The fact that he's there and he's handcuffed, that makes it adversarial. We don't have to have an indictment. We don't have to have an information. We don't have to have a complaint. What we have to have is someone who has been seized by the government, who is now standing eyeball to eyeball before a judge, even if they're acting in capacity as a magistrate. So I think that makes this pretty easy to understand. If you just start off with that assumption, Rothgary is not hard to comprehend. Okay, it's not hard to comprehend. However, that's not it. That's not all of it. Just wait. If you call in the next 15 minutes, I'll throw in three extra chamois. I'm sorry. I watched this bad thing. I think I slept with the TV on. The infomercial was going. And now I'm wanting to buy something to make my thighs thinner. So anyway, all right, now, let me talk to you about what I think the most important thing that y'all might want to hook on to. It's at the bottom of the first page. And this is Justice Alito writing one of his first opinions for the court. He writes a concurring opinion. It's very significant. It's joined by Roberts and Scalia. And this is what he says. He says that the ruling should not be construed to mean that a defendant is entitled to the assistance of appointed counsel as soon as his Sixth Amendment right attaches, and that the term attachment signifies nothing more, maybe you should underline that, nothing more than the beginning of the defendant's prosecution. It does not mark the beginning of a substantive entitlement to the assistance of counsel. All right, now, I think I've got a lot of friends who are criminal defense lawyers. One of them's told me he's hacked off that this is the portion of the opinion that I've decided to give municipal judges in their role as magistrates. All right, I'm just saying this. Anyone who tells you that you can't perform your magistrate duties without an attorney being in that jail with you has not read this opinion. Because guess what? There were some people out there who really were fearful that that was what the opinion was going to say. And you know what? You know, we already have a hard enough time getting new buildings built, old buildings remodeled. Can you imagine if we had to build a sally port on every county and city jail in the state of Texas, one for the arrested individual and another person for the, you know, for their lawyer, so we can have them? I mean, that was kind of the nightmare, you know, kind of the lunatic fringe fear of what this opinion could mean. It didn't go that far. It didn't go that far at all. Now, I have already had a judge call me and say, "Hey, Ryan, I've got a lawyer who's filed a motion in district court stating that my emergency protective order is not valid because it does not comply with Rothgary." I've already had a criminal defense lawyer, because here's the thing. When you inject the Sixth Amendment into the magistration complex, it's a new day in America. We now, as criminal defense lawyers, I can make all different types of new arguments I could not have made before because the wires are now touching. So if you are a criminal defense lawyer, I'm giving you something. This is billable. Make sure you make notes on this. There are some new opportunities for arguments to be made that were not there previously. Okay? Now, let's talk some policy stuff. Let's talk about what the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure states. How many of you remember in 2001, Texas Indigent Defense Act? Y'all remember that? The Texas IDEA. Y'all probably remember Jim Bethke. Jim Bethke used to work for the center. He's now the director for the Task Force on Indigent Defense. Every one of your counties was supposed to come up with an indigent defense plan that complied with the standards set forth by the Texas Indigent Defense Act. How many of you know your county's indigent defense plan? Not one of you? One. Okay. The answer, honestly, folks, should be every one of you. Every single one of you. I don't care if you're never called upon to perform magistrate duties. You better know your indigent defense plan for your county. And I think Rothgary is a great excuse to go back and now to ask, "Can I see that? Can I get a copy of that? I just want it for my files." Because every county has to comply with the standards, and every county is different, and they're not the same. I mean, there are actually, believe it or not, I don't know where they are, but Jim told me there are a couple of counties that in the indigent defense plan, it's actually the magistrate who goes to the wheel to make the appointment. Okay? That is not how it's done in most counties. Typically, y'all correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of what happens in most of your counties is y'all are helping prepare that paperwork that's getting shipped over to the county court, and then that's going to happen over there. It's not going to be happening where you are, okay? Well, there is an interesting debate that happened in 2001. The bean counters, did I say that out loud? I meant the Texas Association of Counties, were very concerned about the cost that indigent defense would have, and justifiably so. I mean, I say that tongue-in-cheek, bean counters, because the fact is, this is expensive stuff, okay? By the way, does anyone know where the vast majority of indigent defense money comes from that county and district court judges use to appoint counsel? Municipal courts, y'all raise 88% of it. Yeah, yeah. It's true. Yeah. Actually, I apologize. 64%. I apologize. Yeah. That you're collecting it in court costs. Y'all know that, right? Y'all, it's one of those court costs you're collecting. All right. Well, and by the way, how much of that court cost do you get to keep in the event you need to make an interest of justice appointment? Like if you have a borderline mentally retarded an 11-year-old who's accused of theft, how much money do y'all get to keep to appoint counsel in the interest of justice as authorized by the code? Zero is the answer to that. Do y'all have the authority to appoint counsel in the interest of justice? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's actually in the article that I'm about to talk to you about. Will you be popular with your finance director, your city council, when you all decide that this is a case that involves the appointment of counsel? No, you'll absolutely not be popular. It might be the end of your judicial career, but it's there. So, hey, you ready to do the right thing and you're ready to move on to greener pastures? Just keep in mind, this is with us. It's Article 1.051J, okay? And 1.051J in the beginning talks about interest of justice appointments, OK? Okay, and any judge in any situation who has criminal jurisdiction can make an interest of justice appointment, regardless if it's fine only. I know that in Dallas County, they actually have a line item budget for this, $40,000. Okay, and I'm just telling you, for those of you who want to, if you like futurism and you want to talk about what's going to, one of these days, you're going to get to see this case before the Court of Criminal Appeals and probably before the U.S. Supreme Court. Because as you all know, everything that we file is a Class C against a child could have been filed in juvenile court as Chins, and if we had filed it in Chins and they were poor, what would they get? They'd get a free lawyer. But there's no counter mechanism in our system. Okay, so we had this debate in 2001 about, you know, the counties were saying, look, if we give them lawyers at it's too early, those lawyers, they bill by the hour. They're going to be running the clock on this. That's going to break us. And so the compromise was this. It's the language that's called 1.051J. It's in your paper. And take a look at the language. The language is interesting. Because what they said, and I'm on page 2 here, notwithstanding, I'm in the second paragraph, a little more than halfway through the second paragraph on the second page, notwithstanding any other provision of this section, if an indigent defendant is released from custody prior to the appointment of counsel under this section, appointment of counsel is not required until the defendant's first court appearance or when adversarial judicial proceedings are initiated, whichever comes first. Underline that word, whichever comes first. Because the implications of Rothgary are what? It just neutered this entire sentence. Because now, when we read adversarial judicial proceedings, we read what? What word can we put in there? Magistration, which always comes first? Magistration. So that is the policy implications of Rothgary, is they just rewrote the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. They just rewrote it. Now, for peace officers, and by the way, criminal defense lawyers, you will want to make note of this, there has already been a change of practice. Because this thing now, I mean, there was a time-honored practice that all of you who have been involved in criminal law know about, that after the person was magistrated but before they bailed out, that they would sometimes get a meet and greet from law enforcement down at the county jail. Okay? In light of Rothgary, if a person checks the box and says they're indigent and they think they need the appointment of counsel, in light of Rothgary, that practice is probably over. So once that right is invoked by someone, the practice of cops going to talk to people down at the jail, which is really a staple of law enforcement, is gone. Now, I have already had a couple of folks, and I think he's not in here, but Judge Ramsey had told me he's already had Denton Police Department saying stuff like, hey, Judge, you mind giving us about 2 more hours before you come down here to magistrate this person? Do y'all see the ethical issue on this? Magistrates are supposed to be what? But neutral and detached. So I want to point that out to you. It's a game changer for law enforcement. It's a game changer for law enforcement. Okay, so let's recap before we move on Rothgary. Do y'all have any questions? The only thing I want to say is this. This sets the stage for something big. This is not necessarily something big, but it's the setting the stage. It's quite exciting to watch how all the pieces are getting positioned. Especially if you like chess. This is like chess, how this whole thing's going to play out. Questions on Rothgary? Going once, going twice, and sleep forever. Okay, moving on. Fifth Amendment. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on this. I just want to give you an update because we already talked about this case last year. N. Ray H.V., municipal court judge from Fort Worth, is acting as a magistrate. We've got a juvenile who has been arrested for killing another juvenile. The municipal judge acting as a magistrate is involved in the taking of the juvenile statement. Y'all know what I'm talking about. This is in the family code. We don't actually take the statement. It's kind of a misnomer. It's more like a three-part dance where we read them their warnings, law enforcement takes the statement, we come back and go over the statement with them, and we kind of certify it. That's a better description of what we actually do. Taking the statement is just kind of the slang that we use. What happened in this particular case was that when she's giving the warnings to the young man, this is what the guy says. He goes, I want to talk to my mom about getting a lawyer. Okay? Now, there's case law that clearly says that requesting to talk, you know, that a request to see a juvenile probation officer is not the same thing as requesting a lawyer. And in the light most favorable to the magistrate, a request to see your mom is not the same thing as a request to see the lawyer. However, we don't use that standard, do we? I had a Pavlov's dog response. I hear the word lawyer, ding, bell goes off, I'm salivating. We probably need to zone in on the fact. She did not construe that as a request for the assistance of counsel. And she continued, she took the statement, she certified it, and then it was suppressed by the district court, the juvenile court. It was suppressed by the juvenile court judge, which is a district court. Judge Jean Boyd is her name. All right, so that's the suppression. Now, the next issue is the state appeals. And they go to the court of appeals and they lose. Okay, and that's what I talked to you all about last year. So, word to the wise, if you're going to be involved in this, you might want to remember In Re A.G. This is a big case for magistrates. All right, now, they appeal it to the Texas Supreme Court, and this is where it gets a little weird, because notice it went to the Supreme Court and not the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I've already told you this is a murder. Why did it go to the Texas Supreme Court and not the Court of Criminal Appeals? Because it's a juvenile law case, and people always lose sight of the fact that even though the conduct is that which we associate with criminality, it is in the envelope of the civil justice universe. You know, it's like this alternate universe where they use all these parallel terms and everything. And I don't know if Bizarro lives over there. By the way, Bizarro, if you don't remember, that's Superman's enemy who was from an alternate universe. His S was backwards. If you didn't remember that, Judge Ellsworth, now you know. Okay. So this was the issue, and this is kind of an interesting twist on the question, though. They not only threw out the statement, they threw out the murder weapon. And the murder weapon was found because of the confession. And the Texas Supreme Court has two or three cases that they've ever written themselves on stuff like this. They have to rely on the Fifth Circuit. They have to rely on the Court of Criminal Appeals. They have to rely on the Supreme Court. But they held that, you know what, fruit of the poisonous tree has absolutely no application to Fifth Amendment cases. This is not novel. This is exactly what the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals have said. Fifth Amendment means that the statement, okay, but the gun itself, that's fruit of the poisonous tree. That's when you violate the Fourth Amendment, okay? And because of that, they sent it back down. Now, I don't know if they can successfully pull off this prosecution about the confession if all they have is the murder weapon. I don't know. Does anyone from Fort Worth, anybody know anything about this case? Been asking that all year. No one's heard any information, so I don't know what's going on with this. Anyway, that's N. Ray H.V. Fourth Amendment. Okay, St. George, this is an important case. It really reaffirms what I talked to y'all about last year, a case called Brendlin versus California. Let me tell you why Brendlin. Let's recap on what Brendlin said. Brendlin stated for the first time that when it comes to Fourth Amendment issues, it's not only the driver of an automobile who has standing to make a Fourth Amendment argument to a court, it can also be made by a passenger in the car. Prior to Brendlin, the Supreme Court had routinely said, you don't have standing. If you weren't the driver, you weren't the one who ever got stopped. You just happened to be in the car with them. Okay? Brendlin changed that. St. George picks up on the same line of reasoning that Brendlin versus California did. I mean, what they're stating, you know, this is a case, you know, the question posed, did the Court of Appeals err in holding that St. George, a passenger in an automobile, was illegally detained when he was questioned by the deputies once the initial reason for the traffic stop had ended? No, they did not err, okay? And this is a significant case because, first of all, it means that the Court of Criminal Appeals is on the same page as the U.S. Supreme Court. That's always a good thing, okay? It means that the standard that's true for the Fourth Amendment is also true for the Texas Constitution. And here's kind of the gem or the pivot point on this. This is a situation where St. George is in the passenger seat. The driver gets pulled over, but the police officer ends up writing a warning citation to the driver. And then it doesn't end. It keeps going on. And his partner is talking to St. George, and they're talking, and they're talking, and they're talking, and ultimately, he ends up getting arrested. And I think that they ended up finding he had, like, outstanding warrants is what I think it was, something like that. Now, keep in mind, this is a very specific, you got to look at this in the light of specific cases. I mean, if they had walked up and had seen kiddie porn in the console or anything else, this would have been a different case, okay? But this was a situation that Judge Myers, in her bright opinion, goes, look, be careful. We're not creating some bright line rule here. We're not, you know, this is not an exacting standard. We're trying to say that generally speaking, guess what? You write that warning ticket, you got to let those people go. And you didn't. Not in this case. All right. So, do y'all see how this could apply to your to cases in your court? Okay. So here we go. Now you got to say, first of all, who issues the most warrants in the entire state? Who's most likely to have outstanding warrants? People who have Class C misdemeanors. Okay, so this could have just as easily have been a Class C misdemeanor case. All right, and so this is something that y'all need to be prepared for. It's one more argument that criminal defense lawyers are now lawfully able to make, and so be it. I think it's a good ruling. All right, Curtis versus State. You know what? This is I'm going to skip this one in the interest of time. Let's get to Franks versus State, page 8 and 9. This is a good case. Let's see. I see we got Judge Williams. She's from Austin. What part of Austin do you live in?
I live in the
Hill. Okay. All right. Are you familiar with the Wyatt Oak Hill? Do you know where that is? When I say like Southwest, okay, then you're going to know exactly where this is. Is there anyone else who's familiar with the little piece of earth called the Wyatt Oak Hill? Okay. The Wyatt Oak Hill is it's an interesting piece of Highway 290-71 heading southwest out of Austin, like you're heading towards Johnson City or going out to Dripping Springs. And you got to make this choice. You either go to Dripping Springs or you wind back around towards Lakeway. Okay, and there is a rest stop that was built during during FDR's administration. This is a public works project that was made out of solid granite that was taken out of Convict Hill, which is where the granite that was used to build the state capitol was excavated from. And have any of y'all ever worked with granite? Anybody ever have any experience working with granite? It's heavy. And additionally, it's hard to move. And that's probably the reason why this rest stop is still up, okay? Because what's happened is over a period of time, they keep expanding the highway, and they've expanded the highway to the point now, okay, that this rest stop and this granite structure is, man, I want to say it's like 10 to 15 feet from the road, which I don't know about y'all. I'm not stopping with my family at a rest stop where some drunk driver could very easily come, you know, wheeling off the road and take me out and take my family out. All right, now, why do I tell you this? Because I'm trying to set the stage, because this is where this whole thing goes down. Here's a fact pattern. We've got a Toyota Camry, a black Toyota Camry, that is parked at this rest stop. And we've got an Austin police officer who has seen this vehicle and has seen it en route to a call and has seen it again a second time and then finally decides on like the third day, or actually I think it's the very next day, to go see what's going on. It's about dusk. And so the car pulls up and the police officer got a partner with him. And as the vehicle, as his car comes to a stop, he sees that the lights very quickly come on and go off. Cab light goes on and goes off. Now, something else you need to know. APD calls this in to dispatch, and they call it in as check welfare, okay? Which, how many of y'all are familiar with that term? You're familiar with the term check welfare? Okay, typically that is used by law enforcement when they're engaged in what we call community caretaking. In other words, they're not here because they think crime's afoot. They're here because maybe someone's stranded, maybe someone has died in the car. They're here to try to protect and serve. They're not here to necessarily do traditional law enforcement functions. All right, now, female gets out of the vehicle. She's upset. She begins crying. She's had some type of altercation, some type of disagreement with significant other. And peace officer does look in the back seat. And they look in the back seat, and this is what they see. They see two things. And I know this is a family show, but I'm just going to tell you what they see in plain view. They see a sawed-off aluminum can, and then they see a container of edible sexual-flavored lubricant. Okay. Now, you might think that's strange. I just want a caveat. We are in Austin, Texas. Remember this now, and that's the first caveat. And secondly, you might ask yourself, you know, was that plain view? Is it a criminal? You know, is there anything criminal there? You know, the cop didn't seem to think so. I've had someone say, well, that sawed-off can could have been drug paraphernalia. Okay, the cop didn't go there, didn't go in that direction. You know, what we know next happens is that the lady says, I want to leave, can I go, I just want to go, and then this is where the pivot point is on the whole fact pattern. Police officer says, no, you can't. Okay, do you see what's just happened? What began as check welfare and was reported to dispatch as check welfare has now become a definite law enforcement activity. And ultimately, they go through the car and they find heroin in the car, and she's arrested and she's charged. And at trial, this thing is suppressed. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed the suppression. And why? Because of something that most criminal defense lawyers will tell you rarely, if ever, happens. Community caretaking was used to the advantage of a criminal defendant. Let me clean out my ears. Let me say it one more time. Once again, where are my criminal defense lawyers? Where are y'all? Raise your hands. I saw your... How often is community caretaking used to the strategic advantage of a criminal defendant? Not often. No, in fact, most criminal defense lawyers will tell you it's a pretext. It is just an institutionalized pretext doctrine that allows police officers to get people without having any probable cause. But in this notable case, it was actually used the other way around. It was used the other way around. Because once the police officer called it in on dispatch, they had boxed themselves in. Now, a friend of mine argued this case, and I asked her, I said, let me ask you something, Kristen. If the peace officer had said during the suppression hearing that the reason why I decided to investigate is because I believed that I had reasonable suspicion that someone was in violation of the Transportation Code's prohibition of camping at a rest stop, would that have changed your fact pattern? And she said, yes, I think it would have. She said, thank goodness that's not illegal under the Transportation Code. And I said, guess what? It is. It is. All right. So, now I want to say this too. Thank goodness we have peace officers who tell the truth and don't lie under oath. You could see how a bad cop, might have altered what he was telling the truth, which is what he's supposed to do. Okay? And so I think this case probably played out properly. Good case to know. Good case. Okay, State versus Griffey. This is my Whataburger case. How many of you like Whataburger? You eat a Whataburger? I like Whataburger. I gotta say this. The fact pattern is unique. This is a situation where we've got someone who has passed out, but we got the manager of the restaurant calling police dispatch stating that we have a person who has passed out in the drive-through window and that the cops need to come. Now, I just want to say, I've already said I like Whataburger, so let me also say this. If you're looking for a fast drive-through, do not go to Whataburger, okay? I have gone through Whataburger drive-thrus that by the time I got my food, I felt like I had lost maybe 5 pounds. I have also been to Whataburgers and such a period of time had passed that I felt like I needed to carbon date my food. Okay? And so the whole idea of a fast drive-thru at Whataburger, I'm thinking, man, heck, I may have even taken a couple of naps in the Whataburger drive-thru before. So at first, this case really didn't pique my curiosity that much. But then what happens next ought to catch your interest, because by the time the police officer gets there, the vehicle has moved up to the actual window. It's no longer, you know, further back. The person's awake, and the peace officer then uses his car to cut off the other car from being able to move forward. This is another one of those classic pivot points in the fact pattern. Because what did that police officer have, if anything, prior to that point? Did he even have reasonable suspicion? Well, no, the manager had reasonable suspicion. What did he have? Did he give himself the opportunity to observe? Did he do any investigation before he came to the determination that reasonable suspicion? No, he did nothing. He cut the car off at the pass. Okay, now, there is another case out of the Third Court of Appeals in Austin. And this is a case called Fudge versus State. It was written by Matt Kidd. It was written back on, it's like 2002. And in this case, it's a similar case. It happens on South Congress Avenue and Ben White. And y'all know South Congress Avenue and Ben White is? But I feel like Tom. I'm like, you know, MapQuest today, talking about all these physical locations. And in that case, we had a taxi cab driver who told the police officer, hey, man, it's like 3 a.m. in the morning. Hey, man, there's a car, it's weaving all over the road. Some guy, he's drunk, he's coming this way, he's driving down South Congress Avenue. Okay? You know, just want you to know. Which, by the way, I want to tell you, South Congress Avenue, 3 a.m., yeah, there are a lot of drunks probably going down South Congress Avenue at 3 a.m. Anyway, white car pulls into the gas station parking lot. Peace officer spends no time whatsoever to independently verify or ascertain the facts, goes out, gets the guy out of the car, hooks him up on DWI charges. Court of Appeals in that case said okay, because the taxi cab operator had no motive to lie. We, you know, had already made personal contact. And so I find these cases to be a little axiomatic. I have a hard time figuring out how long, you know, when it came to the taxi cab driver, it was good, you know, it was good enough. But when it comes to the manager at Whataburger, it wasn't good enough. I don't know. Maybe the Third Court of Appeals, maybe they like taxi cab drivers, or maybe they thought that the manager just simply could not cut the mustard. I'm sorry, bad pun. I've been waiting all day to say that. All right, now let's move on. Do y'all remember when we changed the law in Texas to make spinning, exhibition of acceleration, it became a Class B misdemeanor? Are y'all still seeing these things filed in your courts? Y'all should not be. You know, you shouldn't be seeing it because we don't have jurisdiction of it. If you get it, boom, purge it. Lack of jurisdiction. That'd be no different than them filing capital murder in your court. Just purge it. Don't need a motion, no jurisdiction, it's gone. All right, now, this is an interesting case because of the fact that, and for those of y'all who are unfamiliar with the statute, the Transportation Code has an offense called racing on the highway, which for me always brings about images of some epic Bruce Springsteen album, okay? And one of the subsets, there are multiple offenses in there, and one of the offenses in the crime is called exhibition of acceleration. It used to be a Class C, now it's a Class A. And one of the things that's notable about the offense is that, you know, by the way, cops commonly call this thing like spinning or squealing of tires. Sometimes they couldn't even get the name of the offense right. You know, they would use the wrong charge. But when you read the statute itself, here's what's notable. The Third Court of Appeals, correctly, in my opinion, they point this out, it actually can be read to imply that the person actually has to be involved in a street race, okay? Later on in the statute, it almost appears that you could be having like timed trials, like people are taking turns to see how fast they can make their cars go. But the way that the Court of Appeals in Austin read this thing is they read it to mean, you know, that you actually have to be having like, you know, some American Graffiti type thing, like, you know, a person with a flag and two cars side by side. And that's just not what we had here. We had a situation where a police car is behind a person's truck, and when they go, there's video footage of the car spinning its tires and, you know, burning rubber, if you will. And so they use that as the basis of the stop, and they ultimately end up getting this guy on DWI, and he's convicted. And well, here is the issue on this. It's not illegal to spin your tires unless, under the racing on the highway thing, you're doing it in the context of a street race. Do y'all remember when this law changed? One of the things I had said during legislative update, and I actually talked to a lot of city attorneys and government lawyers about this, is this would be a prime opportunity for cities to adopt ordinances prohibiting the spinning or squealing of tires. So my question to you is, how many of y'all have an ordinance that prohibits the spinning or squealing of tires? City ordinance, okay? Because guess what? Judge Williams, we don't have one in Austin. And that's exactly why this whole case went down in flames. So once again, this just goes to show, if your police officers are confused about how the law has changed, or if they think they have authorities that they don't, these things can have certain implications. We're kind of on a tear on Third Court of Appeals decisions. Have you noticed a trend so far? Yeah, they're always going for the defense so far. All right, now, Virginia versus Moore. We're now back to the United States Supreme Court. I think this is the case that no one talked about it. This is like the sleeper hit of the year or something. You know, it's like it didn't go direct to video, but it certainly wasn't a box office champion. And I don't know why, because this is really a pretty fascinating case. Virginia versus Moore, let me give you the fact pattern. The state, watch it, I gotta be careful. I got chewed out by a judge. I do understand that Virginia is not a state. Please do not write a letter to my boss. I understand it's the Commonwealth, okay? The Commonwealth of Virginia. The Commonwealth of Virginia has a crime that makes it illegal to drive while license invalid. Sounds familiar, huh? Okay. Now, they don't use citations. They use something that they call a summons. Okay, and a summons is very similar, okay, to a citation. You know, essentially they say, I think you've done this, and you have to go to court on this date. In other words, I don't think they can plead by mail. I think, you know, the summons is they're telling them when they have to go to court. Now, this is what happens. This is where it gets interesting. They also have a law that prohibits you from arresting people who are DWLI. Now, for those of you who are, how many of you all think that seems like bad policy? How many of you are opposed? Police officers should be able to arrest people who are driving with license invalid. How many of you think that's a fair policy? Okay. Now, here's where it gets a little interesting. You know, in Texas, we have a similar policy, right? We have a list of certain offenses that you may not make an on-view arrest for. You must first extend the opportunity to sign a written promise to appear. What are the two offenses in Texas that we have decided? Speeding, and what's the other one? Open container. Yikes. Okay, anyway, I'm just going to leave that one there. Okay. I'm not drunk yet, but catch me about 40 miles down the road. We'll see how I'm working it out. Anyway, all right, now anyway, there goes prevention. Okay, well anyway, so this is what happens next. We've got this officer, they pull this fella over, and he's got, he's driving while license invalid, and you know what they do? They hook him up. He gets the full Monty. He gets the full ride, okay? They arrest him. They search his car. They take him to, and by the way, they find drugs in the car, and they take him to jail, and he's prosecuted for drugs. And his whole argument is, guess what? If you had followed the law, you would have never found my drugs, okay? And that evidence should be suppressed. Now, I don't know if the Commonwealth has no state exclusionary rule. I have no clue. This is the part I'm still confused about, and I've given the speech 10 times now, and I'm still confused about this. But what I do know is this. If they had an exclusionary rule, it wasn't applied. Because they admitted that evidence of those drugs, and they convicted this guy. Okay? So this is their argument now. The argument now is the Supreme Court of the United States should give us relief because they violated his Fourth Amendment rights by arresting him instead of giving him a summons. All right, now this gets interesting. And this is how it's pertinent to us. Because their entire argument is based off of a Supreme Court case that came out of Texas. And I see that we do have one of the judges from Lago Vista. Y'all remember Atwater versus the city of Lago Vista? You remember Gail Atwater? She got arrested for no seatbelt. She didn't have her kids restrained. She didn't have a driver's license. I still remember the officer's name, Bart Turek. Okay? Do you know Bart Turek? Does he still work I don't know this guy, but I've talked about him, so I need to meet this guy someday because I talk about him all the time. Okay. So Bart Turek, he arrests Gail Atwater. Next thing you know, we got legal history on our hands. Okay, we got a 5-4 decision all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And what did they say? Do y'all remember? They said that the Fourth Amendment is not about what you get arrested for. It's about the manner in which that arrest is made. And is it reasonable? And if Texas wants to allow people to get arrested for things, that's states' rights. We're not getting into that. We're staying away from that. But this is what they said. We're in the business of seeing if the arrest is reasonable, and that opened the door for the argument that Moore is making in this case. Because he had had some luck. He had some luck. And actually, wait a minute. That must have been exactly what happened. Because I think I've answered my own question. Look at the style of the case. It's Virginia versus Moore, so they're the appellants. So he must have prevailed. He prevailed in the court of last resort, making a Fourth Amendment argument. And now, here's the Supreme Court to try to decide if the Commonwealth of Virginia got it right. Here's what they did. They used Atwater, they used the Lago Vista case to shoot down the arguments. And this is what they said. Wait a minute, whoa, whoa, whoa. Your invitation is essentially an invitation for this court to use its Fourth Amendment powers to micromanage and check state application of state rules of procedure governing arrest. That's not our job. The Fourth Amendment is not about your code of criminal procedure or your exclusionary rule. And guess what? We refuse to use our exclusionary rule to undo a violation of state arrest law. Now, let me back up just a little bit, because that's a mouthful. They violated their own dadgum laws. They were supposed to give this guy a summons. They didn't give him a summons. They hooked him up and searched his car. That should shock you. Okay? Because it could happen in your state. Because it probably has already happened in your state. Are any of you aware of anyone who has been arrested for speeding? I am. Are any of you aware of someone who has been arrested for having an open container of alcohol in the car? I am. And it's not because they refused to sign the citation. That's different. That is not. We know you get arrested if you don't sign the ticket, right? Ask Ricky Williams. We all know what happens if you don't sign the ticket. You're going to jail, okay? But what I'm saying is, what if we just cut to the chase? No ticket for you, sir. I'm arresting you. The Supreme Court refuses to use its Fourth Amendment jurisprudence to correct inapplication of state law governing arrest. They're not going to do it. And they cite Atwater in the process. Once again, we're not about what you get arrested for. We're about the reasonableness of the arrest. And so the you know, Moore's trying to say, exactly. That's Atwater. That's what we're saying. Court didn't go for it. All right, now, so how could this possibly, why does this relate to what we're doing in the great state of Texas? Oh, just wait, my friends. It will become readily apparent. Okay? This is a great case. This is my favorite case of the year. Okay, I got to stop for a second. How many of y'all know that Gary Ellsworth owns a movie theater? Did y'all know that Judge Ellsworth owns a movie theater in Spearman, Texas? If you ever get a chance, you need to take your family to Judge Ellsworth's movie theater in Spearman. I just pulled a Hope Lockridge. Did you catch that? I called you Judge Spearman. Okay, now, I've only known you for 10 years. I'm working on it. Okay, so anyway, this is almost like a movie. How many of y'all, did y'all see The Dark Knight, the Batman movie that came out last time? How many of you saw that? Did you like it? Okay. Did you see Iron Man? That came out last summer too. Raise your hands if you saw that. How many of you saw it not because you have children? Be honest. My kid couldn't even watch it, but I saw both of them. All right. Okay. How many did you see The Hulk? The Hulk didn't quite... Okay, I liked it. I thought it was good. I don't know what the deal was. Which did you like best, Dark Knight or Iron Man? I'm just curious. Okay, I see a show of hands. All in favor of Iron Man, please raise your hands. All in favor of The Dark Knight. All of you wondering why Turner is asking these questions. Okay, now I'll deal with it. Okay, put your hands down. All right. Well, if you like characters like that, let me introduce you to a new character. This is a vigilante of sorts that we like to call the tower, okay? And the tower likes to do business in downtown Houston, Texas, all right? Listen up, Judge Phillips. This is your cup of tea. The tower has decided that he's going to stomp out, using his vigilante powers, wrongdoers and criminals downtown. And he has a real eye for drunk drivers, because he doesn't like drunk drivers in downtown Houston. And go figure. I can't possibly fathom that we have any drunk drivers in downtown Houston, Texas on a Saturday night. All right, now, the tower is a man on a mission. So when he sees a person who he believes is driving drunk, he tries to pull him over using his lights. But when the guy doesn't stop, it's time to execute citizen's arrest. This is what happens next. This is undisputed. The tower ends up running over curbs, ignoring stoplights, running through stop signs, disregarding traffic control devices, and in the process of doing justice, racks up, I don't know, go figure, 15 or 16 Class C misdemeanors. At the end, this cat has got this dude pinned in an alley. I don't know if he's sitting on top of him, but in the screenplay version of the story, that's how it concludes. He's sitting on the guy waiting for the cops to come. Police show up, they arrest the drunk driver. The drunk driver is convicted, and now we're on our way up the food chain of appeals. You gotta love appeals, because by the way, there are a lot of lawyers. That's how they make their living, okay? So this thing is going on, and here we are. It's before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and here is the argument. Did multiple violations of Texas traffic law while executing a citizen's arrest trigger the exclusionary rule? Okay, now I want to make it clear, we're talking state exclusionary rule. What is that, Article 3823 of the Code of Criminal Procedure? I think that's right. Okay, now, this is the reason why I love this case. One, it's funny, okay? There's something about this case that's funny. Secondly, it's very informative. probably a lot of y'all know who Judge Kathy Cochran is on the Court of Criminal Appeals. She's one of my favorites. She has written this opinion where she not only explains our exclusionary rule, she contrasts it to the federal exclusionary rule and explains where our exclusionary rule came from. And I'm going to tell you something I bet you didn't know. The federal exclusionary rule, by the way, if you're ever a student at St. Edward's University, or if any of your children ever intend on being a student of mine at St. Edward's University, this is on the test. So listen up, okay? Federal exclusionary rule does not protect you against the actions of private citizens. You have to know that to pass one of my exams, okay? It does not. Federal exclusionary rule only, so in other words, if you're dealing crystal meth out of your garage and you got a snoopy neighbor who decides to go into your garage and get your crystal meth, you're hosed because there's no application of the federal exclusionary rule to the conduct of private actors as long as they're not co-opted by the government. Okay? But guess what? Texas is different. The Texas exclusionary rule does apply to the citizens of the state. And I'm like, why? I thought we were Texas. Aren't we supposed to be the harshest of the harsh? Seems like you're being a little soft on this. Kathy Cochran explains, oh yes, it had to do with a little period we called prohibition here in the state of Texas. It had to do with the fact that we had some good God-fearing people who thought that alcohol was evil. They thought it was so evil that they didn't have any problem actually kicking in your door and dragging you out of your house just to find your hooch. So the Texas legislature created an exclusionary rule that not only applied to the cops, it applied to your neighbors. Okay. That's one in favor of Mr. Miles here, who got pinned by the tower. Okay, so this is what happens next. Now they have to say, is this the type of rule that we deem applicable to apply the exclusionary rule to? Oh well. You know, my son, he's four, he's almost four, and he's been learning all these new words, and I think I've told some of y'all this in the past. You know how it is with kids, and they pick up on the language you use, and so you try to, you get in this situation where it's like, my wife is trying to say, you know, she heard from a book, or I think Hope told her, try not to tell him no. Try to get him to read, not now. You can't do it now. You can have that later, or maybe tomorrow. And so my son has gotten to the point now where we ask him, hey, Liam, do you need a potty? And he goes, not today. And I go, whoa. And I go, hey, Liam, Daddy needs to know, is your diaper dirty? Not yet. And he says, I don't think so, and all these other things. So I think it's kind of backfired on us. And in a way, now I know that's crazy, I'm telling you a story. In a way, it's very similar to what happens in federal case law and state case law when we're trying to figure out what the feds are doing and what they mean by what they're saying. Okay? Because he's relying, he's making essentially the same type of argument that was made to the United States Supreme Court in this last case I was talking to you about. And I guess the only thing I should say is that I guess you could say that question, did multiple violations of the Texas traffic law while executing a citizen's arrest trigger the exclusionary rule? Court of Criminal Appeals said not today. Okay? They said not today because they said this is that by using the exclusionary rule to deter people from committing Class C misdemeanors while committing, while trying to execute a citizen's arrest, that doesn't effectuate the intent of the rule. You know? So apparently traffic safety is not a big voter among the nine on the CCA. All right, let's move on. Handcuffing. Nothing like talking about a little handcuffing before lunch. I don't want to spend a lot of time on these at all. I just want to just very quickly point this out to you. Another red herring, and this is something that I, as a criminal justice nerd, have fallen into this trap before, and I don't want y'all to fall into this too. You know, one of the easiest sucker punch questions that you can pull on an exam is have an exam question where someone gets handcuffed and then ask the person, are they under arrest? Okay? Because there is one case that says that when a person's not free to move about, they're under arrest. But there are other cases that say, yeah, but you have to apply that rule in light of the totality of the circumstances, okay? And these two cases stand for that proposition. Here are two cases where an individual, both of these men were handcuffed, and neither one of these men were arrested. And I think you judges need to be very, very aware of this. First one, I mean, look, this is a horrible case. How many folks do I have who are from a Gulf Coast region? Where are my Houston folks? Houston. All right. This is a case, y'all remember, this is the case where gang members turned on one of their own and sexually assaulted this guy with a metal pole. Do you remember this? This is on the Texas AP Wire. Okay, this was big news. Guy almost dies. It's a horrible case. And the cops come down, and they're not even surprised to see him. And they're like, hey, can my sister come with us? I mean, it's really an odd case. And they go, hey, look, we're detectives. We don't have a cruiser. Are you willing to come down and talk to the station? Come to the station and talk with us? Yeah, no problem. Can my sister come with us? They're like, yeah, probably not a good idea. By the way, we're going to have to handcuff you because it's standard policy. Because we don't have, like, the safety glass in our car. Oh, no problem. He gets handcuffed. It's not a problem, of course, until he's indicted. Now he's being charged. Now it's, you've arrested my guy. Was he under arrest? No, he wasn't. Okay, next one. This is back in Austin. Okay, and I have to say, I love Austin. I love it. I cannot think of any other place I'd want to live than Austin, Texas, except when the Republic of Texas biker rally is occurring. Then I can think of no other place I would rather live than Austin, Texas, or Central Texas. Now, I know I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to get in trouble with some of y'all. Where are my motorcycle owners? Make your presence known. I know you're here. Some of you are in the demographic. I can pick you out. All right, now, here is, I can spot guilty people just like that. That's the reason why you want me on your jury. No joke. Had someone say that to me once during voir dire. I was like, ooh, not good for the state. Okay, now, person was struck. Okay, here we go. This is a situation, and you know it's never a good scene when you've got the following words up here, okay? When you've got the word biker rally concert, nothing good is about to happen. Let me just say that, okay? Let me also throw in that the headliner is Ted Nugent. Ted Cat Scratch Fever Nugent. And we have a situation where people are drunk. And let me just also say this. When I was growing up in Vernon, my stepdad, Jerry, told me two things. He said, look, you need to know this. One, I expect you to always do your best. Okay, so he said, the other thing you need to know is this, and this is very important. Listen up, now that you're an adolescent. If you ever get an earring or a motorcycle, I will kick your ass out of my house. I didn't even have an earring. I had no desire in even owning a motorcycle. Okay? This man, 3 years after I move out of the house, he gets an earring and he buys a motorcycle. Okay? Now, that's what I call a hypocrite. And his friends are the ones who come to this thing from Vernon. They get on their bikes and they come down there and, you know, this is a big deal for them. And so I could just imagine all my dad's friends at this thing. And then this bad thing happens where this guy gets drunk and he wheels off and he punches this woman in the face. And, you know, that's horrible. But what makes it worse is we got a situation where it's like you've got her entire family is there. All of her brothers. I don't know where you come from, but that means a butt kicking is about to occur in my neck of the woods. That's just how we roll in Vernon, Texas, Wilbarger County. Not a good idea to punch up on someone when their entire clan is there to take you out. They start taking this guy apart like, you know, cheap beef jerky. And the next thing you know, you got a Williamson County sheriff who is basically having to handcuff the guy and, like, at gunpoint, keep everyone else back and get him into the car so they can transport him to a different part of the area just to question him about punching this lady in the face. Yeah, did the cop debatably save the guy's life? Yeah. What's the argument? You arrested my client when you handcuffed him. All right, moving on. Blood draws. Okay. Nothing big came out of the legislature yet that I can think of. I need to talk to, you and I have not spoken, Susan. Did you see that on the boating under the influence of alcohol? I think there is some type of blood draw thing that got put onto that. Okay, but most of the blood draw bills died. Most of the blood draw bills went nowhere. So here's the rule. You can issue a blood draw warrant as a magistrate if you are an attorney judge of a court of record. Okay? Attorney judge of a court of record. The exception is what we sometimes call the rural parts exception, which is where you have like a district court who serves more than two counties or something that's kind of a little confusing like that. We tried to make it simpler in the last session, but I'm not sure if it helped very much. This thing is absolutely just a curiosity piece. I want to point it out to you. They had a situation where the blood draw was done by someone who wasn't certified. It's like some uncertified person is taking blood at the jail. And the district court judge threw out the guy's driver's license suspension on the basis that the guy didn't have the right tech, wasn't certified to draw the blood. Don't think criminal defense lawyers aren't going to remember that one. Okay. Secondly, this one comes out of the Gulf Coast region. And this is a situation where a JP issued a blood draw warrant. And the attorneys tried to say, look, the JP can't do it. He's not an attorney. There is no such thing as a JP court of record. There was like within like the neighboring town, there was another JP who was also a municipal judge who was also an attorney. Nice argument, but misses one critical part of the analysis, doesn't it? It's not enough to be an attorney. You must be an attorney judge of a court of record, and that's what the standard is for issuing blood draw warrants. Okay? More on that. We'll talk more about that at legislative update. Okay, substantive law issues. Folks, this is, in my opinion, the most important case of the year. This is a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case. This is a Class C misdemeanor that came out of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and this defendant was convicted of a non-appearance crime, but apparently no one ever knew which non-appearance crime he was arrested of. Is it FTA? Is it VPTA? Here's what y'all need to hold the heart on this. It matters. As judges, you better know the difference between failure to appear and violate promise to appear, because this man was, he got a speeding ticket. It was filed in the Houston Municipal Court. He didn't show up. He got convicted of some non-appearance crime. It was never clear in the record if it was FTA or VPTA. The fine, can y'all help me out? I think it even says, I think it was like $237. It was more than the $200 that you could have got, because maximum, he got $400? Okay. The maximum fine for violate promise to appear is $200. The maximum fine for failure to appear is $500. VPTA, violate promise to appear, only applies to traffic offenders who commit subtitle C rule of the road offenses and don't show up to court in accord with their written promise to appear. FTA applies to everything else that's left, and bail jumping. That's the difference, okay? So this is what happens. This guy should have been convicted of VPTA, but he wasn't. He looks like he got convicted of FTA. The Court of Appeals, the county court said, no harm, no foul. The Houston Court of Appeals, in one of the worst appellate decisions I've ever read issued by any intermediate court of appeals, said, close enough for government work. That's essentially what they said. He didn't show up. That's all we know. Okay? And are any of y'all from Houston? Got anyone from the Houston area? Do y'all know who like Alex Walton is? You know who Alex Walton is? He is like a traffic lawyer that I think has driven the city attorneys and a lot of the probably municipal courts insane. He took this thing up on PDR. Now, after everyone has voted against him, he takes it up to the Court of Criminal Appeals and gets a unanimous opinion. And this is what they've said, that if a person, that it violates substantive due process to accuse, let alone convict, someone of FTA when the legislature has given you a more specific rule. Now, that is important, because I know a lot of municipal courts don't care, and they've been treating them like they're one and the same. So you better, this is one to tune in on. And here's the second thing. It does matter for other reasons that the court didn't even talk about. FTA doesn't go on your driving record. VPTA does. Okay? The court costs are not the same. Okay? Here's the big thing. A friend of mine, John Bradley, he's the district attorney in Williamson County. He writes a little article for TDCAA, and he said, you know, what's the big deal? So if you don't show up, you get a fine. That ought to teach him. That's not the point. The point is that debatably in the last 20 years, every year, 10 to 15,000 people have been charged with the wrong offense and have been overfined. They have been overpunished for conduct. If you look at how much money was involved in this, this opinion potentially suggests that we have imposed tens of millions of dollars in illegal fines because people never thought this was that big of a deal. And it is. It really is that big of a deal. So I want to emphasize, I definitely want to emphasize this case. All right, now I'm almost out of time, so let me talk to you about this. Dangerous dog cases. Oh my goodness, will this ever end? All right, next time, Marilyn, you and I are going to work on this with TMCA. We're going to get this fixed in the next session. We got to get this fixed because they're trying to fix it, but they still haven't fixed it. Look, y'all can hear dangerous dog cases, and if your animal control authority determines a dog to be dangerous, they can appeal it to either you, the JP, or the county judge. But guess what? According to the AG, doesn't matter if you're a court of record or not, you're stuck with it once you got it. So don't try to lateral the case out. You're not going to be able to say, I really think that the JP ought to hear it. You cannot do that. Okay, that's what this AG opinion says. And here's the other thing. Nor can your decision be appealed, apparently, anywhere. And this is very disturbing to a lot of folks because you're doing this not as a magistrate. You're really doing this as a trial court judge, but it's kind of like a civil quasi-property anomaly. And so we have a situation here where this individual, his dog's determined to be dangerous, and I think this is in Grapevine, and he's now trying to appeal this thing to the county court of law in Tarrant County, and the county court of law just said, I don't have any jurisdiction. Look, the only thing that the law contemplates being appealed out of municipal court are criminal cases. I can't help you out. Okay, so this thing is still going on in some form. I've heard that the pit bull, the pit bull that was in custody of the city has now not only had like a whole litter of puppies, but I think that like maybe they're even like crossbreeding and inbreeding now. I've heard that there's a real breeding issue and that they would like this case to come to a conclusion because these things are multiplying like tribbles from the old Star Trek show. Okay, so that's what we got on dogs. I want to close with this one. I just want to talk to you very quickly about, here we go. Let's talk about Crook. I talked about it a lot when it came down. It scared the fire out of a bunch of folks. Folks, there is no there on this case. This is another Court of Criminal Appeals case where this fella out in El Paso gets tagged on barratry charges. Okay, 13 indictments, 13 convictions. The jury recommends 13$10,000 fines. Okay. The judge then says, I'm going to allow you to discharge these judgments concurrently, which means that you get to pay $10,000 once, and it applies to all 13 counts. Okay, point one, we don't use counts in municipal court. We can. I have just never seen them. Have any of y'all ever seen a complaint in municipal court that uses multiple counts? It's probably poor practice for your prosecutors, especially in light of this case. Secondly, our charging instruments are so different. I mean, it goes back to charging instruments. This was a multiple count indictment. That's like a repeating rifle. What we use in municipal courts more like a single shot shotgun. I mean, you have one case, one judgment, one style of the case. And that doesn't mean you can't try multiple cases at the same time. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that even if you were to have a trial and try multiple complaints, you would have separate verdicts, separate judgments. And that makes this somewhat different too. The other thing is, for those of you who don't know why this thing got everyone so worked up, Kathy Cochran in her dissent said, this is such a bad decision that let me make sure I got this straight. So you're saying under your rationale that if a person were to speed, not wear their seatbelt, and get a ticket for no insurance, that they could go down to municipal justice court and just pay the highest fine. She says, Is that what I understand you? Now, does that mean that Judge Cochran believes that? Absolutely not. It was in a dissent. She said that to illustrate how far off base she thought the other camp was on this. Now, let me close with this. The other reason why this is something that you will see this case cited. I guarantee you're going to see this case cited. You need to know this. It's not controlling authority because it didn't get the requisite number of votes. You have to have 5 votes in the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals for a case to be cited as controlling precedent. They only got 4 votes and 1 concurring. Judge Keller refused to sign on to the opinion. She just concurred to the outcome. She never subscribed to the legal reasoning, which means that, yes, it's a big win for Mr. Crook. And I'm sorry, that is a funny name. That's a really bad break if you're going to end up being accused of being a criminal. But Mr. Crook got the break on this. And so, yes, it was good news for Mr. Crook. But to think that Crook now changes the law, I've got Westlaw and LexisNexis tracking this. I am looking for courts of appeals to cite this. It's been cited twice and not for the proposition that I imagined. Because the argument's going to go, hey, look, this all came out of the same fact pattern, the same events. So because it's one continuous criminal episode, which, by the way, if I were your prosecutors, I would be denying and arguing against, not wearing your seatbelt, not having insurance, and speeding are not part. Just because you got caught all at the same time doesn't mean that it was part of a campaign of criminality, like a continuing episode. The argument will be made that they can essentially pay the highest fine, and they're going to cite the dissent in this. And now I'm not saying that this issue is not worthy of citing for law review articles or even to try to generate further debate on the subject. There was a bill that would have completely ended this debate, but the legislature, I think, rightfully concluded, you're giving the opinion too much credence. That bill didn't even get out of it. It didn't even get a committee hearing. So, all right, folks, you take care. I will see you later, and I'll talk to you later. Thank you very much.
Okay. Very, very quickly, before you get out of here, if you were in Track A, passenger restraint laws, Track A, you're going to be in here. Track B, driver's license offenses.
Point clearly.
Is here.
Okay.
In these two rooms. Waterfront, that's the one across the way that you can see the swimming pool, so you may want to change your mind. And if you're going to the art and mechanics of the jury trial, you'll be next door in Caribbean 3. And Judge Susan Carver, where are you? You win the bracelet. Have a great lunch.